Hi there, folks. Welcome to another episode of the A Minute to Midnight show. This is Tony and I'm coming to you from New Zealand. And with me on the show, I have John Haller in Ohio. John's obviously been a frequent guest for a long time. But John, it's been a little while since you've been on this time around. So it is good to see you again.
Yeah, I think I was on back in October.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly. I think I just come back from Israel. And then I've made another trip to Israel and back since then
uh-huh.
too. So.
Yeah, that's true. So, okay, I guess, you know, talking about Israel and things associated with that, we obviously had that terrorist attack in Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia. I've been to Bondi Beach. It's quite a long time ago, but just one time. But it's not that I want to spend too much time on this subject, but I think what's really interesting to me is immediately, instead of going, hang on a second, these guys are Islamic terrorists. Why are they able to do this? You know, the first thing is we need to tighten up the gun laws, the usual thing. And
usual
Australia already has tight gun laws, tighter than New Zealand as it is. And so it's like knee-jerk reaction. Straight away I start thinking about what happened here when we had the attack in 2019 when a mosque was shot up by an Australian. And, of course, they use that as an excuse to really tighten up gun laws here in New Zealand. And it's the same playbook. It makes me think false flag, you know. Obviously, people really did get killed, and it's terrible what happened. But you start wondering, I start thinking, was there some planning involved in this, you know, just because it's very convenient to roll out the next kind of phase of whatever they want to roll out with gun laws and everything else, hate speech and whatever, you know?
I mean, certainly there's a synergy, Tony, between the bad conduct of a certain religion and others in positions of power who, when something like this happens, they immediately jump on it to ratchet things down. So, I mean, we saw this with the Charlie Vector 019er. We saw this with the Patriot Act here almost 25 years ago now. So, you know, I'm always open to being convinced that they actually planned it. But it seems to me that the what I'm seeing now when something like this happens, and having spent a lot of time in Israel over the past couple of months, I'd probably have a different view of things. And I'm concerned with the way this is going.
Yeah.
I'm concerned that we're going to have attacks like this here, and people are warning of this, and it doesn't seem to be taken seriously. But the one thing that I sort of object to is I constantly see this inversion of reality everywhere. You know, people, when something like this happens, so let's say, I mean, I'll use an example of Bondi Beach. So Bondi Beach happens. I think it's clear who did it. I mean, there's videos of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's 15 dead Jewish people, including a 10-year-old girl and older people. You know, a couple tried to stop it and they were shot and killed by their car. And so immediately the Jew-hating people in the world will say, well, Netanyahu sent a letter a few months ago warning Australia that intelligence said that something like this could happen.
Yeah.
And the response is, oh, so Israel planned it. Israel planned it. The Mossad did it. And I just think this is kind of, in my view, it's kind of an idiotic knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, I agree. I mean,
it's easy, but I think if you're doing that, I think it's very low information. But we have a problem. We have a problem with, and I don't like the term anti-Semitism. I would prefer the term Jew hatred. And nobody likes what we see in Gaza, but we need to understand that that was a terror base unlike anything that has ever been seen in human history.
Yeah.
Now they're saying 900 miles of tunnels. And how do you destroy those tunnels when there's buildings on top? So what I would like to do is honest reporting, and it's a pro-Israel website, but they did a very good layout of the tunnels in Gaza. And so what I would like to see somebody do is take the destruction map and overlay it on top of the tunnel map. And I think you're going to find that there's a pretty there's a pretty close correlation there. And I was just down at Gaza twice. The Gaza, what they call the Gaza envelope, went to a couple of the kibbutzim that were attacked. I went to the Nova Festival site a couple times. I talked to some of the first IDF personnel that arrived that day. I talked to the first responder to get to Nova for about an hour. And I mean, this is a battle-hardened guy. This guy served in the first and second Lebanon wars. He was a paratrooper in the IDF. Now he's in emergency services. And the description of what he described of what he saw when he got there. And I have no reason to doubt this guy, okay? It was horrific. It's almost unspeakable. And I've walked through some of the homes where people were murdered. I've walked through the bomb shelters where 24 young people were killed at Nova out of the 300. I think it was 364 killed at the Nova site. I've driven on those roads down there. So it kind of gives you a different perspective. But I've stood there a half mile from the Gaza fence, and you can see buildings in Gaza still. Now, it's not completely flattened. There are still areas that are inhabitable. But look, a large portion of it has been really destroyed. But again, how is that destruction relate to the tunnel network underneath? And I think you're going to find a close correlation. It was interesting when I was in Sederot, which is a town, a city at the north end of the Gaza Strip. As we were walking around different places, you would hear these huge explosions in Gaza because, you know, this was before the ceasefire, before Trump came in October. And the people in Sederot don't even react. I mean, they don't even flinch. And I mean, it's a concussion that you can feel. You know, you can feel the explosive power.
Yeah.
But they're so used to it down there from all the rockets that Hamas will fire and then the war that's taken place. So I'm going to come down on the Israel side on this. We did have some briefings when I was in Israel. One briefing was from Sharon Haskell. She's the deputy foreign minister. Some people are suggesting she might be the next, you know, a candidate for prime minister at some point down the road. And I've met her and talked to her, and she's the interesting thing she said in our briefing. So this would have been on November 6th. We went to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and she talked to us for about an hour. I think the video might still be online. But one of the things she told us, I don't remember if it was in her little talk to us, the group of us that were there, or when we talked to her privately later, that this is when all this stuff in Venezuela was heating up. And she said, look, I get intel reports every day, and a third of the money that Hezbollah gets to fund its operations in Lebanon comes from the drug trade out of Venezuela and South America.
Right.
So she said there's a connection between the two. And so she said, I'm not surprised that I'm grateful that somebody's finally going after that pipeline. So I don't know how the situation is resolved. I will say I've been extremely critical of the Trump administration's.
Yeah, before we go on to that, John, can we just quickly go back to the Bondi Beach thing, and then can move on to that, because what's really interesting to me is that the hero that disarmed one of those Islamic State, you know, gunmen, which obviously they'd had a ISIS flag on their car and all of that type of thing and have been radicalized. But the guy that took the gun off one of them was also a Muslim, and he took the gun off fellow Muslims, yeah, I suppose. But what I wonder, John, is how is the rest of the Muslim world view that person now, having, you know, because of obviously so much of the world hates Jews, and so here he was being hailed as a hero now, having disarmed another Muslim who was killing Jews. I'm just wondering how the rest of the Islamic world will view that man, you know, who's in hospital with 5 gunshot wounds to the arm or whatever. So,
yeah, I've heard that there's a possibility he might lose his arm. I don't know if that's changed in the last 24 hours, but yeah, I mean, he was very brave, and this is the hard thing to do today, because everybody wants to control the narrative.
Yeah.
So his name was Ahmed. I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah.
But then it was, okay, is he from Lebanon? Is he from Syria?
No, he's from India.
He
was from India. No, wait a minute. That was the gunmen that were from India.
They were from India or Pakistan. I can't remember which.
Originally, they reported it to be from Pakistan, I think, but it's actually India. They were actually from India. So,
okay.
Yeah, so this...
The country in the world that has the largest number of population, the largest number of Muslims, is India.
Mm.
A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Indonesia is the largest Muslim country.
Yeah.
India is, you know, mostly Hindu, but they have hundreds of millions of Muslims.
Mm.
And they have terrible internal conflict over this.
Yeah.
And the Hindus have been radicalized too. Our pastor, who's passed away 5 years ago, but when he was in India as a missionary, witnessing to Hindus in Mumbai, they tried to kill him because they, you know, the radical Hindus. So they're just as bad. And a lot of people don't know this. This is a little bit off topic, but a historical fact: the largest genocide in human history was during the Muslim invasion of India back in the 12th and 13th century. It's not really historically known, but you can look it up. I think it's been pretty verified by scholarship. Now, the final number is unknown. Some estimate on the low side, it's 80 million were killed, 80 million Indians, to as many as 500 to 800 million.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if that, and it's the largest genocide in human history. I think everybody agrees on that. And the outflow of that was it did radicalize the Hindus as to how they were going to react.
Hmm.
So this is the, it seems to me to be an irresolvable problem. So I would think if I was this guy, I would move someplace else, and I would, lay very low, because I'm sure there will be people who view him as a problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then I've also heard that he was a Maronite Christian. I'm not sure that I've been able to verify that. Most of the press has identified him in that. But again, Tony,
Netanyahu called him a Muslim too. So I don't know.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah.
So there's always this fight for the control of the narrative. So can we just shift to another terror attack that took place, what appears to be a terror attack, that happened in the United States, I think the day before Bondi Beach or near the same time as Bondi Beach was happening.
Yeah.
And that was at Brown University. Yeah. And so at least what I've been able to piece together, there's a Jewish professor, and she had, I forget what class she has. The shooting took place in her classroom, and one of the people that was killed was probably the leading conservative, politically conservative activist on the Brown University campus. Brown University is an extremely left-wing school.
Yeah.
But you know, so they arrested somebody. Then they said, no, that's not the person. Now there's a person of interest. And his name has been bandied about. I don't know if this guy did it or not, but he is a Palestinian activist. And what makes me believe is that maybe this is the guy, is that Brown University, he was very prominent in parts of the Brown University website because of his activism. And he's been totally scrubbed, like he never existed at Brown University. But Web Archive, people are digging out things that he's written. And there are a number of witnesses. I think there were 60 people in that classroom when the shooting took place. And they, a number of them, somewhere around a dozen, have said he was shouting Allahu Akbar as he shot. So, but this is totally being scrubbed. And the same thing happened down there in at Bondi Beach. The Sydney police, I saw this one lady, she's a police officer, and she was saying, well, you know, we want to promote the diversity is our strength, the usual DEI line. And so there's this fight every time something like this happens now for a control of the narrative. It happens.
And it's always used it's always also used to, we need to control guns rather than we need to control the fact that there's radical people getting the guns, you know, that shouldn't have had them in the first place. It's like, well, we've got to take guns away from average citizens. I know America's not quite that, at that level as other countries yet, but it's heading in that sort of direction. And it's kind of like, it's to me, it's just very interesting to watch how these things are spun in that direction. But just as an aside, you know, the last guest I had on just before you was Ralph Strean. And one of the things Ralph Strean was talking about was we're going to see an increase in anti-Semitic type attacks. And within, I don't know, 2 or 3 days after that, that's exactly what happened. We saw these, at least two, you know, terror type attacks like this. So I do think we're going to see, you know, more of this stuff. And you know, for years people have talked about there being sleeper cells in different countries, and you know, you only need a small percentage of them to rise up and start doing this sort of thing, and it creates massive chaos everywhere.
Well, and there has been a lot of influx of Islamic immigrants. And they came out of Syria during the Syrian Civil War, a lot of them. They came out of the Middle East, other places. And they literally sort of almost overran Europe. And Europe's in a sorry state. I mean, I talk to people in the UK all the time. And I haven't been to the UK since 2018. But even when I was there, Tony, in central London, I saw more burqas than I had seen the prior year in Nablus. In the West Bank and Samaria.
Yeah, that's
pretty crazy. Which is a 100% Muslim town. Well, there's a few Orthodox, but it's a Muslim town. And by the way, you can't go there. Okay. If you told somebody in Israel, in the Israel side of everything, hey, I'm going up to Nablus today, their reaction would be, you are out of your mind. And now I've been there in 2017. Pam and I went with Joel Kramer, just the three of us. So that's probably good. But when my group, my tour group in early October, went to Joshua's altar, clearly the biblical site of Joshua's altar on Mount Ebal in overlooking Nablus, we had to go in a bulletproof window bus with an armed IDF escort. And even then, you know, people would say, you're crazy for going there. But the interesting thing is it's the biblical heartland. It's where all the historical things of the Old Testament, most of them took place. And it's most tours don't go there because it's difficult. So we went to Shiloh, however you want to say it, Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. We went to Bethel. We went to Joshua's altar. We went to Mount Gerizim. and so where you could look down on Shechem. I had friends who went to Joseph's tomb right by the ancient site of Shechem in Nablus a few months before we were there, and they went in. They had to go in with a complete armored IDF escort to go there to a Jewish site, the tomb of Joseph, and it is the tomb of Joseph. So it's kind of hard to describe the situation. Can I give you one example? This is, I noticed this when we were in Israel. So we would go up, we went to Shiloh, we went down to Ephrat between Jerusalem and Hebron, where the tomb of Machpelah is. And I noticed this on the way back from Shiloh one day. We came back at night, and on the way up, you see all these brand new apartment buildings in these Arab villages. I mean, they're obviously new. In Nablus, they're all over the place. And in Ephrat, which is biblical Ephrat, Bethlehem Ephrata, you can read about it in the Old Testament. It's where David grew up. There's a valley, and in the valley, there's a place called Solomon's Pools, which was part of the water system that fed the water to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem for the first and second temples. Some of it came from springs and water at Hebron in that place. But so across the valley, though, is the south part of Bethlehem. And in the south part of Bethlehem, there, and I don't know if I talked about this last time or not, but it's kind of shocking to see there's all these new apartment buildings. I mean, the whole hillside is new apartment buildings on the Palestinian side. So Ephrat is a condominium community. It's Jewish, or they're, and they would be, I would call them Zionist Orthodox. You see, everybody carries a weapon, and a lot of them carried automatic weapons. Like, we went to synagogue for Shabbat, and the guys who came and sat down on either side of me had, you know, Kalashnikovs or AK-47s that they, you know, took off their shoulder and put under their seat in the synagogue.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is one guy says, look, I want to show you the front of my home here in Ephrat, Bethlehem, right across the valley. Look at all the bullet marks on my home. That's why, and he's a lawyer, and that's why I carry. But when we left at night after going to dinner, a Shabbat dinner at a rabbi's house, we came out, and Ephrat, there are lights all over the place. You look across the valley on those new apartment buildings. This was true there. It was true on a drive down from Shiloh and Arab villages. There's not a single light in any window. So I inquired locally, and the reason is there's nobody living there. It's all fake building to make it look like they're more Palestinian Arabs than they really are.
Right.
It's a propaganda operation. And it's kind of shocking because they're nice apartment. The interesting thing is in Nablus, they have all these nice apartment buildings, right? But right there next to Shechem, the ancient city of Shem, there's a refugee camp. It's been there since 1948. There's all new apartment buildings all over the place, but they still live in that refugee camp because they're political pawns. You have to see it to believe it.
Yeah, that sounds crazy. Okay, John, just
it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't seem to, but let's move back to where you were going to go before with the whole thing with the Trump administration and Venezuela, and you know, that's a complex situation too, because I guess Russia and China are involved in this as well. So if you start making war on Venezuela, you're kind of stepping on some toes there too.
Yeah, I would say that it's sort of like, where do you want to start about the whole wars and rumors of wars? I really do think we are in the end times. I don't know when they're going to end, but there certainly is a convergence of events. So, yeah, this Venezuela thing, you know, I'm not sure I understand exactly. I mean, I understand why Trump is doing it. And I will say I have people who are American patriots, and they write to me and they're like, I don't like the way this is going, because they're going to take this concern about fentanyl and other drugs, and they're going to use it to put more control on people.
Yeah.
And I understand that. The flip side of that is have 100,000 people in the United States dying. 100,000 people dying from fentanyl overdoses every year. And so how do you manage that problem? And I don't know. So I'm not convinced that we have, look, we know the solution ultimately is the gospel and that type of thing, but you also need to take other action to kind of keep people alive so they can hear the gospel.
Yeah.
And where do you draw that line?
But is so the real thing, is the real reason for this anything to do with fentanyl and drugs, or is it more to do with oil and resources?
Well, I don't know, but I do know that, listen, fentanyl is a real problem here in the United States. I mean, we have family members who've come out of that addiction and that type of thing, and it's awful.
And
it does drive. I mean, I met J.D. Vance, and that he wrote his book Hillbilly Elegy about his experience with drugs and his family down in Middletown, Ohio. And I've had some cases down there. I'm just telling you, it's a completely devastated economy. It's a huge problem. I mean, so I don't know what the answer is, but yeah, look, Venezuela probably is the most oil-rich region on planet Earth, at least in terms of known reserves, above Saudi Arabia. So, but you know, they're certainly in league with China and Russia, and you know, the Russians have been very good for a long time about playing everybody off against each other to make absolute chaos in the world. I mean, they were the ones who really created the whole Palestinian narrative back in the 60s. That's very easy to document historically. So you have Russia doing that, and you know, you have China threatening Taiwan, and you have Russia threatening Europe, and you have Europe threatening Russia, and that type of thing. My own personal opinion is I don't know if China's going to go after Taiwan. It would be a very difficult military operation. And there are some people who are pretty good analysts in that area and say that the whole Chinese thing is about their methodology of war is deception. So maybe they're saying Taiwan when really their goal is something else. And I was just watching, and this is about the third or fourth person that's a pretty good Russian analyst saying maybe China's going to go after gas and oil resources in Siberia, actually, instead of going after Taiwan. So because they've deceived everybody to think they're going after Taiwan, and China and Russia don't really get along that well. But the Middle East is in a big state of turmoil. I'm very concerned. I've talked for a long time about Turkey. I think Turkey was behind the Syrian revolution that took place a little over a year ago. And now we have, you know, American soldiers that were killed by a suicide bomber. And you see pictures of the suicide bomber standing 4 feet away from al-Shalani or al-Shara, the new president of Syria. Clearly he's on it. He's at least was enough of an insider. And I'm very distressed by the reaction of the Trump administration to say, hey, you know, we're sure that al-Shara had nothing to do with that. I don't believe it. And we see these agreements being reached with Qatar. We talk, you know, Trump's big Board of Peace plan in Gaza is going to have Turkish, well, supposedly Turkish and other Islamic troops, you know, from other troops from other Islamic countries. In fact, I heard recently they were thinking about bringing 20,000 Indonesians in to act as a peace, the, what do they call it? International Stabilization Force in Gaza. But Indonesia is a Muslim country. Yeah. And out of the hundreds of anti-Israel resolutions at the UN since 1948, Indonesia has voted in opposite of Israel's interest every single time, 100%. And we're going to bring those people in and put them on the border of Israel. I think this is a recipe for war. But I heard an interview the other day. So I think Turkey is behind what happened in Syria. Turkey just announced that there were hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees that had returned to Syria. Because what happened during the Syrian civil war? The Assad regime wanted to get rid of the Sunnis with Russia's help. They barrel bomb Sunni towns. They all left. They went to Jordan. They went to Lebanon. They went to Europe, millions of them. Now the war's over. Syria has been, the Assad regime has fallen. And I heard a pretty good analyst, her name is Ruth Wasserman Land, on I-24 News just last week. It was in my update on Sunday, if you want to find it near the end. She said there's no Syria anymore. It's Turkey. And I would agree with her. And Turkey's really pushing into Central Asia through the tribal Turkmen regions of Central Asia, the Stan republics, as we call them. I'm just telling you, there's a lot of stuff happening, a lot of things moving here. And I have no idea where this is going to go, but I do think that Turkey has been very patient and clever. And I think they are effectively in control of Syria right now. They're going to go after the Kurds. They already are. And I'm not sure why we're there, to be honest with you. I don't know what we're doing. I think we might have 1,000 troops in northeastern Syria. It's an oil region again. So maybe we're there to protect the oil interests. I don't know. I don't know how much oil is coming out of there. But I don't know. There's massive problems everywhere. It's going to be a very turbulent 2026. In fact, I think we're going to be about 2 weeks into 2026, and people are going to say, boy, they're going to start longing for the good old days of 2025.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that's going to take very long.
If you looked at the Economist magazine, The World in 2026, and right. take that as a any sort of predictions, it looks pretty dire for 2026.
Yeah, and then, you know, you layer on top of this rise of, you know, technology
yeah.
and artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure. I don't know how far they get down the road on, you know, super intelligence or whatever they're trying to get to. They seem to keep building bigger and bigger data farms. I mean, it's all over here in Central Ohio. It's affecting the economy. The traffic's awful now all the time. It's affecting our electricity. But I'm sort of thinking now that the artificial intelligence push is really more of a cover for putting in a control grid to kind of control everybody.
Yeah.
I think that's the bigger story.
It is, I think. You could, because the control grid's being erected in every way, shape, or form. And they will have these data centers to be able to store everything on every one of us. So, yeah, it's pretty concerning. And people just buy into it. Oh, this is great, you know. And everyone, I'm surprised really just how many people are using AI for, and it's become such a part of everyone's life. We all know where this is going, and yet lots of Christians are basically using the technology. And at what point do you jump off the escalator when it's, you know, heading down?
Well, it's true. I mean, I try to not consciously do it, but I will say that it seems to be, it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere you look. And everything, you know, your searches that you do on your phone and everything now are all AI powered. Yeah. So if I do a Google search or another search engine, I get this curated response. So if it's, you know, so I recently upgraded my home internet to fiber. And so I was looking at ways to set this up. And so I just, you know, Googled it or did a search engine. And I got these instructions that actually, I will tell you, Tony, they're really, really good. it saved me a lot of time. I have a friend, son of a friend, he's an attorney. He had four lawyers in his law firm in addition to himself. How many do you think he has now working in his firm? Him is the only one. The other four have been let go.
But that's not actually a good
because
thing.
Because he's using AI.
Yeah, but in terms of everything, that's actually not very good, because what's happening is these robots and AI are taking over human jobs. And yet people, right. It's like, okay, so all of these people are going to have all this free time and that to use AI, and we can just all be like Elon Musk sort of says, everyone can just be in leisure mode pretty much and no one will have to work anymore, which I think is a load of nonsense. That's not what they want at all. But what is happening is, you know, and the Trump administration is bringing back industry to America, but it's not industry with people. It's all robots and AI driven stuff, except for the construction of the buildings, obviously, where they're using people. But once that's done, then they don't need these people for jobs because they'll have robots and AI. And
if Elon Musk has his way, in fact, somebody just sent me a white paper yesterday on the economics of putting the data farms in space. Right. And Elon Musk is very much. So if you remember when the Trump administration started, Elon had a net worth of about $250 billion. He's now entered into an agreement with Tesla that if he hits certain targets, he's going to get a $1 trillion bonus.
Yeah.
I mean, and so, but then I saw a story yesterday, and his net worth went down. Everybody said, oh, see, it's over. He's got problems. Tony. Yesterday, so it just was posted.
$600 billion.
He's worth $600 billion.
Yeah.
Dollars.
Yeah.
I mean, and so Trump has started this Genesis mission or whatever they call it. And I always the terminology kind of drags biblical stuff into it is kind of problematic. I think I don't like that.
Yeah.
There was Project Stargate.
Yeah.
But. You know, they've gone so far beyond that. And now you've got four or five U.S. tech companies that are worth more, with any one of which alone is many times the value of all the companies in Europe.
So we see all these people going, oh, the Trump, this is exactly the presidency we needed because they're doing this, this, and this. But what's actually happened is all of these tech guys, these billionaire tech guys who are mostly transhumanists, I mean, they're not transhumanists themselves, but they believe in transhumanism, are Trump's friends and are making mega bucks and creating the whole infrastructure like faster than ever before to bring us into this digital slavery. And people can't see that. They're just like, I mean, a lot of our listeners can, but the majority of people aren't.
Yeah, the other track too is as people can see where it's going.
Yeah.
I don't have any future. And they're not having children. The demographics of the world are collapsing all over the place, which is like Bill Gates' dream, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
His dream was what was on the Georgia Guidestones, which they tore down.
Yeah.
Maybe because they figured we don't need to publicize this anymore because it's going to happen naturally anyway.
Yeah.
The birth rate, female fertility rate needs to be 2.1 for replacement rate. In South Korea, it's way under one. And in major cities in China, it's 0.2.
Right.
Which means that I saw an article on The Economist, and this is on the front of The Economist. They talk about, the economy going down eventually, but the population does too. And like in, I don't know, it was 12 generations or 15 generations, there might only be 50 million people alive on planet Earth.
Hmm.
Now, that's the AI, the technocracy guys' dream. We can control 50 million people a lot better than 8 billion.
Yeah.
And, if we need something, we'll just have a robot for it.
Yeah.
And so you see, so there's this as the technology comes up and the population is starting to decline in some major countries, going down a couple million a year, people aren't sick and dying. They're just not there.
Yeah.
There's no babies. And I think even in America now, deaths exceed births. This has never really happened in, except for very short periods of time in human history. So it certainly seems like when you sort of start tracking all these different things and how they seem to play into the end times, it's easy to say that, you know, everything's apocalyptic now. It would be a shorter list of things that aren't. And I don't know. I will say this. I'm glad I'm an old guy. So I know that I have sort of a limited time left anyway, but good grief, Tony. It's unbelievable.
It is crazy. So I guess as we look to wrap up, you know, we are Christians and we don't want to be given into hopelessness or, you know, just resigned to the fact that, oh, well, everything's going downhill and you get negative and depressed. So, you know, how do we actually face this thing down and stay on top of it ourselves and keep in step with the Lord and having faith rather than fear and depression?
Well, you know, that's interesting because I've been thinking about this, actually. We're sort of in this paradox. We know that it seems like we're at the end and Jesus is coming back soon. We just don't know how soon. And we know that some of these things that we see happening appear to be on a track where they're inevitable. They're going to happen regardless of what we do. But then we also have biblical admonitions that we're supposed to be occupied till he comes and salt and light. And so it's a real paradox that we find ourselves in. So I think we try to resist this bad stuff as much as we can. It may not be the time. Maybe it's going to get even much, much worse. Kind of hard to get your head around that. And we just need to live as people of the book, share the gospel. And I will tell you, I mean, I study this stuff all the time, and I very rarely get distressed. Okay. I mean, I just don't feel like I'm in despair because I know how it all works out and that, you know, God has our back. And I think that maybe the attitude we should have is not so much how can I make my life better, but how can I live my life in a way that's pleasing and glorifying to God.
Yeah, true. Yep. So, John, if people want to find you and your shows, you know, your personal and your church and that, how do they go about finding you online?
Yeah, Fellowship Bible Chapel, at Fellowship Bible Chapel is YouTube channel, Real FBC on Rumble. And then if you go to one of my recent Technocracy roundtables and you dig into the show notes, you'll see like all the different places you can connect with me on social media, you know, Telegram, X, Getter, True Social. I do a lot of interviews and talks with people. I do these roundtables every now and then. And so anyway, that's where you can get me. And I do plan to do another trip to Israel in October. You can contact me if you were interested in getting information on that. It'll be up on the church website probably in the next week or so.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks again. It's been another very interesting discussion, and I guess it'll be the last one for this year. So probably early next year we should look to connect again. And meanwhile, have a great Christmas and a good new year, which will come around real quick, I'm sure.
Okay. Yeah, and I always wonder is when the poles shift, does that mean we get summer in December like you guys have?
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, well.
I mean, I'd be interested. There's stuff going on there that is very kind of hard to wrap your head around. And that, I don't know what's going to be the outcome of that, but that seems to be an unusual anomaly also that we're dealing with. So anyway, but look, I'm not in distress. I trust in the Lord, and I think that'll get us through.
Yeah, amen to that. All right, so thanks, John. It's been great to have you on the show again this year. And, yeah, look forward to more of them next year.
Okay. Likewise.
Cheers. And, folks, don't forget to subscribe to us at aminutetomidnight.com by going down the right-hand side of the page and enter your email address where it says subscribe to blog. And we do run A Minute to Midnight 100% by donations. I want to thank the people that do donate to us. It's always very much appreciated. And if anyone else wants to help us through donating, that is also much appreciated. And you can do that at our website, aminutetomidnight.com, where there are a few different options for ways to donate. And the music used, I've written, played, and recorded. God bless, God willing, we'll be back soon with another episode of the show.